Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I'm getting up
soon in the morning. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about brain addiction to fast foods is real, according to a new imaging study that we'll share with you from Medical News. And then we're going to talk about stress early in life leads to adulthood anxiety and a preference for comfort foods. Then we're going to look at the immune system, and it can drive cancers into a dormant state. And we're going to also look today at something that is not discussed in the mainstream media, or the alternative media for that matter, and that is the diverse ways madness and severe mental illness are culturally defined and understood and treated by the world's number one authority, Professor Andrew Scull, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Science Studies, University of California, San Diego. He is the preeminent historian on mental disease and the practice of psychiatry. He's a graduate from Oxford and Princeton and University College London. So I'm going to spend extra time with him today because it's rare to have someone with this knowledge on such an important topic. Because in America, we look at the symptoms, give a diagnosis, give medication. Also today, the next part of Dr. Suzanne Humphrey's explanation of why she no longer supports vaccination. And we're going to begin with those of you who are still pro-vaccine and say they're harmless. You might have occasionally someone injured. Here's the latest showing it's far worse than you think. And I'm citing only peer-reviewed literature. They took a look in a large study of 1,036,690 children receiving 1,107,000 measles, mumps, rubella vaccines. And they were able to concur, quote, in the conclusion of this article, mind you, this is a mainstream peer-reviewed literature article in the vaccine safety data team. So this is where all your vaccine articles end up. Quote, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine that is given in the second year of life is associated with an increased risk of immune thrombocytopenia purpura. So, one more reason why, in the current scheduling and the age at which these children receive it, you put your child at risk. The immune system is something that is so poorly understood by the medical community. And let me explain why. Over a period of time, when you assault the immune system or your body, multiple systems, you end up causing a tipping. At the point where it tips into disease, suddenly you get symptoms and then you say, better go to the doctor, the emergency room, I've got a problem. A tumor, a stroke, a heart attack, diagnosed as diabetes, arthritis. It could have taken decades of cumulative assaults in order for that to happen. Poisoning of the system, inflammation within the system. We don't pay attention to what precipitated this ever. We have no interest in what causes disease. We have all the interest in treating the symptoms because that's where the money is. This is from Science Daily, and it's a major study. And here's what it says. This is from Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis. Quote, a multinational team of researchers has shown for the first time that the immune system can stop the growth of cancerous tumor without actually killing it. Scientists have been working for years to use the immune system to eradicate cancers, a technique known as immunotherapy. The new findings prove an alternate to this approach exists. When the cancer cannot be killed with immune attacks, it may be possible to find ways to use the immune system to contain it. The results may also explain why some tumors seem to suddenly stop growing and go into lasting periods of dormancy. All right. However, what they call immune, let's say immunotherapy, I call bad medicine. Chemotherapy is a part of that. Radiation is a part of that. That is causing cancer. But their idea is, well, if we use radiation, we can shrink a tumor, which is true. If we use chemotherapy, we can temporarily stop a cancer, which is also true in many kinds of cancers. What they don't tell you is what happens is that 6 months or a year later, the cancer comes back, but now you have no immune system, and so you've gotten two rounds of radiation and chemotherapy, possibly surgery, and then they say, time for hospice care. And yet they call that immunotherapy. So when you attack the body's immune system, it's not immunotherapy. When you build up the immune system in a healthy way, turn off inflammation, that is immunotherapy. Hence, everyone in this audience who is following a healthy diet, you're practicing immunotherapy every single time you have a juice or a healthy meal. Now, we know that stress kills, and we know it causes heart attacks and strokes. In fact, one of the things we're finding out are people who are walking around angry, and that's a lot of people, and rageful, that's also a lot of people in America, they're not aware that they're causing buildup of amyloid plaque in the brain and also tiny little specks of white. Those are microstrokes frequently. And a microstroke is not a stroke that ends up causing paralysis and puts you in a hospital, because some people could have thousands of these. And when do they most likely happen? When you're angry. When you're yelling, screaming. So just keep in mind, for those people who choose to stay angry, and often self-righteously angry, you're really killing yourself. But now a Society for the Study of Ingested Behavior, at their annual meeting, have an interesting group of findings. And here's what they say. New research finds that in this study, laboratory study, that stressful neonatal environments demonstrates more anxiety and stress and preference for eating more foods rich in fat and sugar. Well, the takeaway message is that if you're stressed early in life and you have no way of getting out of the stress, as a baby, a toddler, child, even a young teenager does not, then you have to adapt to the stress. Almost all adaptation is maladaptation. We adapt to relationships until one day we ask ourselves, in an ideal situation, is this what I would want in my relationship? And more often than not, the answer is absolutely not. Well, if you wouldn't allow a stranger to treat you with disrespect, why would you allow this person in your relationship to do that? Well, you maladapt to it. You don't want to confront something. You know what the person's behavior is going to be like, so you simply adapt. Interesting, in a workplace, when someone finally is fired or quits, everyone else then says, thank goodness. Well, why didn't they get together and say, this is not the kind of environment that we want, and you're not allowing us to be respected in this environment. All you're doing is acting out as if somehow you have a right to control our environment also. And that's when people start reaching for comfort foods. So this study is showing that if you were stressed out early in life, you're going to likely end up with anxiety as an adult and acting out and eating comfort foods. Now take a look around at how many hundreds of millions of Americans are overweight or obese, and they're fully aware that what they're doing is not healthy, but it's the only refuge they have, they believe, for their anxiety, comfort foods. So that's the latest study there. Also, fatty acids found in fish linked to lower risk of breast cancer. This is good news from the British Medical Journal. The present study looked at people who had a diet rich in fish, and of course the fat in fish, and found they were substantially less likely to have breast cancer. Now there's two ways you could approach this. It may be the oil in the fish specifically, or it also may be the omega-3 fatty acids, in which case you could get the same benefits by having flaxseed oil and walnuts and other and chia seeds, a hemp oil. But this was non-specific. So for now, it's just, want to lower your risk of breast cancer, fatty fish. And also, six ingredients are sold in the United States, but they're banned in other countries. I believe we have to ask why. Well, why is it they cause cancer and organ failure, but the United States still allows them to be sold? Other countries, no. And one of the ingredients that's in a lot of the frozen dinners and box pastas and bread, packaged baked goods, it's used to bleach flour. It's even used in all forms of conditions, which induces asthma. It's been banned in Australia, the United Kingdom, most European nations. And this is azodicarbonand. And I'm going to give you the spelling of these just so you can write them down. And that way, when you're looking at ingredients, you come across this azodicarbonamide. You'll say, no, I don't want it. Also, brominated vegetable oils. Brominated, bro, B-R-O, minated, M-I-N-A-T-E-D. You're going to find these in sports drinks, citrus-flavored sodas, many Mountain Dew varieties. And it's also used in carpets to make them flame retardant. And they build up in the tissues. And if you're a soda consumer, it can lead to symptoms of hearing loss, schizophrenia, growth problems, birth defects, and major organ damage. And yet it's banned in 100 countries, but not the United States. Potassium bromate. Bromate, B-R-O-M-A-T-E. It's derived from the same chemical as brominated vegetable oil and is used in baked products. And it causes cancer, nervous system damage, and kidney damage. It's banned in Canada, in China, and United, but not the United States. Also, Olean, Olestra, O-L-E-S-T-R-A. It's all over the place. You really have to be careful because it can reduce fat absorption in the digestive system. It can cause vitamin depletion, cramping, anal leakage, and yet it's not banned here. And arsenic is a poison and a tool of murder. And yet it's used in chicken to make them pinker. It can kill you, but it makes your chicken pretty. So how smart is that? So those are some ingredients we should not have in the United States. And finally, according to the latest research published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, highly processed carbohydrates, that's your breads, your pastas, your cakes, cookies, bagels, muffins, can trigger the same brain mechanism associated with addiction of, like, heroin. Same kind of reaction. In other words, eating a high glycemic food, such as your processed carbohydrates, can stimulate overwhelming hunger in those regions of the brain associated with reward and cravings. And that's the latest research on this. So that's why you should get off all these high glycemic foods and break that cycle. And if you're under the right care and doing it intelligently, you won't crave white rice, bagels, pretzels, potato chips, the sugar frosted cereals, etc. So that's the last important issue on health today. We're going to take a little break, come back, and then a couple quick commentaries, and then we're going to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to have an in-depth interview with Professor Andrew Scull, the Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Science Studies, University of California, on mental illness and why we don't understand it. Throughout all of history, you'll find it an interesting discussion. Before that, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on why she no longer recommends vaccination for anything to anyone. And she's a mainstream board-certified physician who looked for the truth, opened a closet, and didn't realize everything that would come falling out. If she could do it, why can other physicians and scientists? Before we go there, however, I have some short topic discussions, starting with a person. And this is to answer your question, Claire, about, well, you said, Ralph Nader, what did he do? I was mentioning what wouldn't be around in the world today, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, 9/11, the Iraq War, Afghan War, Yemen War, Libya, militarized state, evisceration of the Constitution, 17 spy agencies, bloated budget, all these things that would not have been present if Ralph Nader had been elected. But you ask a specific question. Here's what Ralph Nader did create, even though he was never a member of Congress, because of his insight, determination, that no other person has done as much in American history. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Consumer Credit Disclosure Law, Consumer Product Safety Act, the Co-op Bank Bill, the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the Freedom of Information Act, Funeral Home Cost Disclosure Law, Law Establishing Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, Medical Device Safety, Mine Health and Safety Act, Mobile Home Safety Act, the National Automobile and Highway Traffic Safety Act, the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act, the Natural Gas Pipeline Safety Act, the Nuclear Power Safety Act, Occupational Safety and Health Act, the OSHA, the Pension Protection Law that protects all of your pensions. So think about that. You couldn't vote for Ralph Nader because the Nation magazine and the dilettantes that live there and the Council on Foreign Relations, they share the same hotel room, didn't believe he was electable. He was a dinosaur, some relic? They wanted someone that was really a populist who could bring back the right standards, like John Kerry. Remember that? Or Al Gore. Al's done very nice for himself, just not for the rest of the planet. And but without Ralph Nader, you wouldn't have protection in your pension. So all your school teachers who couldn't vote for him, and firefighters, and city and government and federal employers, he, no one else, he alone caused your pension to be protected. Now they want to take away your pensions. Oh, really? Do you think they'd get away with that if Ralph was still in power? Not a chance. But with Obama, the best president in American history, for those oligarchs and sociopaths, oh, they will take away your pensions. What they did in Greece and what they've done in Italy, they're going to do here. Then see if you go to the streets. The Safe Water Drinking Act, the Tire Safety and Grading Disclosure Law, the Whistleblower Protection Act, which, by the way, two people from the Pacifica board have now signed on to blow the whistle on Pacifica. All of its allegations of crimes and misdemeanors will now be coming forth to the Attorney General and other possible agencies of government. So put on your seatbelts. A whole lot of stuff that many people have known was wrong is going to become public very shortly because they're now actually going under the Whistleblower Protection Act, and these are national board members. The Wholesome Meat Act, the Wholesome Poultry Act, and 230 additional acts. And yet, the left, in its hubris, in its conceit, thought that, no, we don't want Ralph. Too bad, because look at what you got by not having him. Now, good news up in Vermont. And for all the people listening from Vermont who helped with this, a big thank you. Because today, Center for Food Safety held the just-issued federal court decision from the U.S. District Court for the District of Vermont affirming the constitutionality of Vermont's genetically engineered food labeling law, Act 120. The ruling fully denied the preliminary injunction motion brought by the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, and other plaintiffs to try and halt the law's implementation, and granted the state of Vermont motion to dismiss on several claims. So now, Vermont, you stand first among all states in making any food that's genetically engineered labeled. And that means that you've set established precedent. Now, they threw over $80 million into every kind of lie and distortion and manipulation. In California, it was easy because it's very easy out there to do anything you want if you're corrupt. And the people just kind of go, oh, okay, but not in Vermont. No, and not in some other states. So now I see coming in the next 2 years a lot more states. And so that means those states, the people at least, will have some knowledge that if they're eating the wrong foods. Question for you. I suggested with Gerald Salante 5 years ago that in the future when the U.S.-based dollar is no longer artificially propped up, right now it's about 20 to 25%, inflated above any realistic value. And by the way, if you think, well, isn't that good? Good for whom? Good for the myth that somehow we have a stable dollar? Backed up by what? $176 trillion in underfunded or unfunded entitlements and debts? We're the most bankrupt country in the world, but we also have a powerful military, so no one's going to remind us of it. Now, think of it this way. If the dollar is overvalued, then that means that we're running a $500 billion annual trade deficit. That means other countries that have a lower value on their currency can find their products are cheaper to sell in the United States. Hence, Americans rather buy an inexpensive product at a Walmart than to buy something that is more expensive, possibly made in the USA. But it also means that that's acting like a tariff on every good that America sends in to another country. So our products are more expensive in other countries. Their products are cheaper here. We owe trillions of dollars in trade deficits. So now China and all these other countries have formed their own international bank to challenge the International Monetary Fund, a completely corrupt organization, top to bottom, and the World Bank, which is one of the most evil concoctions from Bretton Woods ever conceived. It causes misery with every stroke of every pen. It's nothing but a house of cards. And if the mainstream media ever decided to do an expose, then it would show that this would just crumble overnight. So with China's economy overtaking the United States in the next year, as the number one economy in the world, not in gross total dollars, but in its domestic production, and we outsourcing all of our jobs, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership has nothing in there concerning stabilization of currencies. Gee whiz, wonder what could go wrong with that. So now other countries can have cheap currencies, hence cheap products made and sold in abundance. We have a higher currency, and nobody wants to buy our products. So we stop manufacturing in the United States, we lose even more millions of jobs to these cheap countries that don't have any labor laws. So slave labor making cars, trucks, bicycles, and refrigerators around the world, and all we can do is import them, that's a prescription for disaster. And then to make sure that no one knows what we're doing, let's just all get together in Washington, one giant septic system, and let's lie. Out and out lie, knowing that no network will challenge us. Not 60 Minutes, not 2020, none of these people are going to challenge the fact that we're saying we have a 5.3% unemployment rate, where we've already taken 13 million Americans who want to work and can't find work. And we just put them in the closet. They don't exist anymore. Where else do you have this alchemy of economics except in the most vile circumstances? So we lie about everything. We're just pathological liars. We can't tell the truth about anything. And we don't. And we pride ourselves in it. We have this kind of self-righteous moralizing position that no matter how bad it is, we will never tell the truth. Ask someone, what is the only country in the world to use weapons of mass destruction on other people? Well, it's the United States, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Ask someone in administration, didn't we use weapons of mass destruction? Watch them dance around it. And also, this on our environmental, this is from Dar Jamal from Tufaut. Quote, experts warn of cataclysmic changes as planetary temperatures rise. This month's anthropogenic climate disruption dispatch begins with the fact that recently released National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data show that this March, by far the hottest planetary March ever recorded, and the hottest January to March period on record as well. We are watching unprecedented melting of glaciers around the planet, increasing high temperature records, and epic-level droughts that are now becoming the new normal. Planetary distress signals are increasing in volume. One of these took place recently in Antarctica, of all places, where, for the first time in history, they recorded a 63-degree Fahrenheit day. And now they're saying that 12 million people living in coastal areas will be displaced because of the rising water. And also this in, the Navajo Nation is literally dying of thirst, with one of the nation's leaders flatly sounding the alarm by saying, quote, we're going to be out of water. A study just released by Geophysical Research bolsters the case that a period of much faster acceleration of climate change is imminent, if it's not already begun. On that note, leading climate researchers recently said there's a possibility the world will see a 6 degrees Celsius temperature increase, which will lead to, quote, cataclysmic changes and unimaginable consequences for human civilization. Then it goes into what is happening and why, and the fact that we're still not doing anything about it. I will be doing an in-depth special, a six-hour special, on the Progressive Radio Network in the near future on the tipping points that are happening now, what to do about them, and what the rest of the public around the world seems not to be interested in until it happens. Remember, the only time we pay attention is once something has happened. Look at the earthquake, Kathmandu. Look at the giant amount of the boreal forest that normally would be in frozen permafrost that is now thawing and allowing billions of tons of methane into the atmosphere. Look at what happens when you have the floor of the Arctic melt, and 50 times more methane is locked in there than all of the CO2 or methane that's been released since the 1800s till now. So we have a lot to pay attention to, or we will be caught up in it. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going over and say what Dr. Suzanne Humphreys has to say that led her to saying no more vaccines for her or her patients. And this is an Orthodox doctor, professor of medicine, board-certified nephrology, internal medicine, who simply took a look at why so many of her patients were sickening and dying, not from kidney disease, but from the vaccines they got when they went in the hospital to get their dialysis. Here's what she has to say in part five.
Another area that bothered me was, why do my patients not show the same side effects as each other? Why do vaccines seem to be tolerated by some people, and for others it can be devastating? Why do some adverse effects happen immediately, and others take weeks or months to fully appear? This bothered me greatly because the vaccine program is a one-size-fits-all operation. The hospital gave vaccines routinely, no matter what, to anyone who consented. However, in my research, I came across a very interesting study which opened my eyes to the fact that the individual uniqueness has been totally left out of the vaccine effect equation. In 2013, Dr. Orntoff published research detailing the genetic network changes in white blood cells before and then 6 weeks after DTP booster vaccination in 8 different girls. Here's a list of the top networks altered after the vaccine, and they're listed according to their significance. The reason this study was undertaken was that DTP shots in African studies have increased the short-term death rate in vaccinees. You can probably appreciate that there's a big difference in the array of changes between these girls and why one-size-fits-all vaccination programs cannot be acceptable across the board. What this study proves is that after a vaccine, you're not just going to get a fever, good DTP immunity, and a sore arm, because different genes are activated in different people. And remember, these are just the genes measured in some white blood cells and not in the whole body. Looking at a more clear slide, this is a partial list of the top genetic networks that are altered in the 8 girls after vaccination with those DTP shots. Here's another study showing how many undesirable gene networks can become active after vaccination. This was a human study where 5 infants got the usual first 2 sets of vaccines at 3 and 5 months. Then they had their blood drawn at 6 months. Those blood cells were re-stimulated with pertussis toxin, which is a component in the DPT vaccines. The following results were noted: allergy, asthma, cancer, and immunological disease genes were upregulated. If you want to know what the immunological explanation is for the gene changes that happen after DTP and DTAP vaccines, I can't tell you, because as Dr. Orntoff said in 2013, they haven't studied it and they don't know. But if you want to follow common sense, you'll work on the principle that some gene expression changes might be an indicator of bad things to come, and the consequences of vaccination could be varied and potentially devastating. One very prominent vaccinologist, Gregory Poland from Mayo Clinic, who is also the editor-in-chief of Elsevier's journal Vaccine, has published widely. He states that the genes upregulated for an immune response are myriad, and activation patterns differ significantly between people after vaccination. The current vaccine program, according to Dr. Poland, does not allow an informed understanding of an individual's genetically determined risk for an adverse effect due to a vaccine. He's also known for saying how the current MMR vaccine is significantly troubled by primary and secondary vaccine failure, and therefore eradication under its use is not possible. He wants to develop the next generation of vaccines to try to incite a more thorough and reliable immune response to measles in very young babies. Dr. Olivia White et al. States in the journal Vaccine that vaccine side effects are more likely to involve aberrant cell-mediated immune responses. And the best testing to look at cell-mediated immunity as a measure of vaccine side effects is available, but not required or routinely used as part of safety or immunogenicity testing. Dr. White described how complicated the immune system is. The cellular and humoral immune response involves many different cell lines and communication networks within the immune system. And specific immune responses involve the coordinate activation of hundreds to thousands of genes. Dr. Kimmon corroborates Poland, White, Orntoft, and others, who states that the immune response is highly complicated and variable from person to person. Kimmon speaks to the likelihood that vaccine non-responders are also those who are more likely to be susceptible to the worst form of disease. What this means in practice is that healthy children who do respond to vaccines are the ones who would have had a good prognosis and have recovered uneventfully. Poland's research can determine the genetics involved in both vaccine antibody response and disease prognosis. But he cannot mention the implication of that, which is that the majority of parents are vaccinating their healthy children for diseases they would easily have recovered from with no complications. Nor can he tell parents that the children who do not respond well to the vaccine are the ones who will have the worst time with the disease. Individual variation is very clearly seen in kidney patients because their immune systems are much more fragile than healthy people. As nephrologists, we often land up giving dialysis patients numerous high-dose hepatitis B vaccines. Many of our patients do not develop antibodies, because their immune systems don't work properly. Some of those dialysis patients got really annoyed when the antibody tests showed no response, because then they're given so many injections. Yet we can't even guarantee that these patients with no antibodies won't get the disease after they're vaccinated numerous times. Did vaccines contribute to my patient's temporally related issues because different genes got up or down regulated, just like the children who are vaccinated? Do we have any studies to show that over periods of days, weeks, or months, this is not a risk? No. But we do have genetic studies and clinical case reports that show it is possible. I believe that the kind of study Orntoff did on the children should also be done on healthy people to see whether routine vaccines are a trigger for acute kidney disease, and on kidney patients as well. I believe that clinicians should have access to such testing because patients deserve better care and better answers when policy results in unintended consequences for them.
And you were listening to Dr. Susanna Humphreys. Keep in mind that she has spent thousands upon thousands of hours reviewing all of the world's scientific literature on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And she has come right out in her part one of this series, all of which are posted on our archive, saying that there is no such thing as a safe or effective vaccine. There are over 930,000 physicians in the United States. I know of 20 who are advocates, much like Dr. Humphreys, of doing double-blind placebo-controlled studies, and yet they refuse to be done, taking one group, giving them all the vaccines, another group no vaccines, then following them carefully, cross-matching individuals for a period of 5 years, and doing about 1,000 people. Right now, the studies that do exist shows that unvaccinated are healthier than vaccinated, yet the real independent science is not what is being used by the pro-vaccine people and their advocates, including in the liberal press like The Nation and Mother Jones and MSNBC and Bill Maher and others, to attack those who have done their homework. Part 5 tomorrow. Now let's go to La Jolla, California. Standing by is Professor Andrew Scull. That's S-C-U-L-L. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Science Studies, University of California, San Diego. He's widely regarded as one of the world's most preeminent historians on mental disease and the practice of psychiatry. He holds degrees from Oxford and an MA and PhD in sociology from Princeton and completed postdoctoral work in medical history at University College London. He has received many honors in his work and has published in many different journals, peer-reviewed journals. Nice to have you with us today. Professor Scull?
For you to have me on, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity to chat.
I want to extend my congratulations and, quite frankly, my admiration for the scope of your opus work about the cultural influences that define madness and insanity and other severe mental disorders and their connection with how these mental illnesses are treated. And after you take us on a tour of how societies and civilization have attempted to understand madness, from the ancient times of the early Hebrews through China, India, and the Middle East, and then more on to Europe and the United States, we remain with a sense almost in disbelief that we really don't completely know what madness nor its causes are. It is not that long ago, during the post-World War II period, that methods for treating severe mental disorders are viewed today as barbaric, such as early psychosurgery. And equally, I'm sure that much of our science and the way we define and diagnose today will be viewed as naive and uninformed in the future, such as the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And also, we still employ electroshock therapy, which is unnecessarily brutal. And the images of one flew over the cuckoo's nest is a reality in our lifetime. And since there is so much that we could cover and yet can barely scratch the subject during a short time, I want to at least touch on a few of civilization's early understandings of madness before our modern era. And too often today, a great deal of Western medicine and science is given what I believe is unearned prestige and authority, and there still remains a great deal we can learn from the sciences of other non-Western cultures. I recall reading a book about the Crusades years ago, but from the perspective of the Islamic historians of the time who were critiquing the behavior and practices of the invading Europeans. So when it comes time for medicine, Muslim physicians were appalled. If a wound was turning putrid, European medical treatment was not so much that of raising a broad sword or an axe to amputate a limb, whereas Islamic medicine at that time had a deep understanding of wound healing and even suturing and a far more advanced medical system to know how to reduce inflammation internally. So in order to provide an example of the sharp diversity about how madness mental health practice was interpreted and diagnosed and treated between these two very different cultures during the same era, please juxtapose how madness was interpreted and treated in the Dark Ages of medieval Europe and the Golden Age of Islamic civilization, or even in China, and that's and for sharper distinction. Yes. The form is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. Indeed, what you just said points to the sheer scope of trying to understand madness across so long a period of time in so many cultures. And I agree with you that, unfortunately, in the present, we often are led to exaggerate what we know. But to return to the particular question that you've asked me to address here, the Western Europe during the period we often still talk about as the Dark Ages, the period after the collapse of Roman and urban civilization in the West, really had lost touch with the understanding of the ancients, the understanding that came from Greece and to some degree from Rome. And it was a period where, in many instances, interpretations of madness rested upon religious and folk beliefs about possession, about evil spirits, sometimes about an angry god punishing people for their misbehaviors. And treatments of madness often reflected that. Through even into the early medieval period, and I'll come back to the way in which in that period old medicine begins to come back from the Islamic world. But through that period, for example, the healing power of saints was often touted as a way to respond to many kinds of misfortune and illness, including mental illness, and particularly those Christian saints whose martyrdom had involved beheadings and things like that. Were the site of visits from people often coming a great distance. For example, my book has a series of stained glass windows from a chapel at Canterbury Cathedral in England. There, Thomas à Becket, who was the archbishop and who had challenged the king's authority, had been martyred by being stabbed to death, swords thrust through his head, and there's a very dramatic picture of that in an old prayer book. And so there we see a woman, Matilda of Cologne in Germany, who'd been dragged from the Rhineland all the way down the river across the English Channel, a tremendous journey in those days, beaten along the way, prostrate before the altar, where she's come to be cured by the healing powers of the saints' blood and remains. So that was very common in Christian Europe at that time. Indeed, Christianity won many converts by claiming that its acolytes could perform these kinds of miracles. Now, by contrast, Islam and Islamic civilization in many ways, as you've indicated, was very far ahead of civilization in the West in those years. And, of course, the conquest meant that Islam had spread all, not only through the Middle East, across North Africa and into Spain, even for a very short period into southern France. It was clearly, in many ways, a more advanced civilization. It was one where the first hospitals for segregating mental patients emerged, quite unlike anything in the West. And it was also the place where Greek and Latin wisdom about mental illness, about illness in general, had survived it simply hadn't in the West. When urban civilization collapsed there, to the extent any knowledge survive from the ancient world. It was fragmentary manuscripts. Of course, this is the age before printing. And those manuscripts were held in monasteries scattered across the countryside. But essentially, we'd move back into a world where most people were illiterate, and where that ancient knowledge was really at risk of being lost. And it was preserved to an extent in the remaining Eastern Empire of Rome, but more importantly, eventually, it was the Islamic scholars who translated those works, built upon them, and interestingly enough, it was from the Islamic world that the Christian West re-imported those things. Many of the classical texts on which in many ways our civilization is built, would have been lost but for these Islamic scholars, these Islamic libraries, for the preservation of old texts, and also their translation first into Syriac, into Arabic, and so forth, and then back eventually into what became the language of the educated world in the medieval period, namely Latin. And it really is that, even when printing comes on the scene, the most printed medical textbook in the first 50 years is not the Roman physician that Western medical historians all talk about, Galen, but it was Avicenna, the Arabic physician whose work, the Canon of Medicine, was the centerpiece of Western understanding. It went through many more editions than Galen in the first years of printing, which of course did mark a huge transformation in things. So madness is it had very complicated meanings even back in Greek times. It's while we all think of, for example, Hippocrates, or more properly the Hippocratic tradition, emphasizing, say, the natural origins of epilepsy, that it wasn't the sacred disease, it wasn't somehow divine, but was indeed an affliction of the brain. That was only one strand of Greek and Roman beliefs about madness. There was also, in that time, a temple medicine which involved prayer and fasting and religious rites in an attempt to coax madness out of the person. So understandings of madness, in other words, were very complicated in that world, and clearly in Islam, that complicated mix from Greece survived much better for a period than it did in the West. It had to be re-brought back, and then it dominated in the West for many centuries, really. Understanding evolved a bit, but those ancient beliefs were really very, very powerful in the medieval and into the early modern period.
Turning and focusing our attention on Western civilization, and let's stick with the years from around the start of the flourishing of the Enlightenment, around the mid-18th century to our present time. What do you find in your research that was disturbing and cruel in psychiatric practice that had reached popular support from the scientific community of the time?
Yes, it's an interesting period. Obviously, we often think of it as the so-called Age of Reason, the attempt among enlightened thinkers to regard human beings as primarily characterized by their rational capacities. And in that sense, madness was a great challenge, because obviously it represented at least part of that population, were people who seemed to have lost touch with the common sense everybody else assumed we all shared. There are really two different strands that I think we can trace in the 18th century. There are a group of mental illnesses, if you like, which were of a milder, perhaps of a milder sort, things that were called by such labels as hypochondria, which in those days didn't mean what it means in the modern period, but an illness centered on the upper abdomen, having its origins there, but a mental illness, hysteria, the spleen, and things like that. And those kinds of conditions were treated, for the most part, in one way, often relatively sympathetically, and their social location was meant to be among the well-to-do and the most talented, whose nervous systems and nerves have now become an important part of medical understanding, whose nervous systems were particularly refined and delicate and therefore easily thrown off balance. So that's one group, and late in the century, that's the group of patients by and large whom someone like Anton Mesmer, the Austrian physician who gave us the word mesmerism, treated via his mesmeric trances. The other side of the coin is that the 18th century marks the period when, in the West, some mad people become a source of profit. They come to the attention of people who start to speculate in that kind of human misery, who, as society becomes more affluent, offer their services to take the disruptive mad person off the hands of the family, and obviously that means predominantly well-to-do patients, and put them into places that become known as madhouses. And in the madhouses, what the madhouses offer is some degree of safety, some removal of the potential source of scandal and disruption, but they're often seen as very sinister places. It is the place where attempts are made to try to experiment on how to manage the mad, and some of the devices and techniques that are developed in the latter half of the 18th century really, to modernize, look absolutely extraordinary.
Such as?
So, for example, Erasmus Darwin, Charles' grandfather, who's a physician, reads Roman texts about the value of swinging, and based on his recommendations, various doctors invent devices that will whirl people around, sort of like an e-ride at Disney World, and cause them to lose consciousness, to vomit, to void their bowels and their bladders. And supposedly that treatment will, by shock, restore people to sanity. Or again, devices are developed to simulate drowning. Well, sometimes they don't just simulate drowning, they actually do drown the patient. Coffins with holes drilled in the lids and patients. Imagine a mad person, somebody who's raving or extremely depressed, being shoved into a coffin, the lid closed, and then the thing lowered into a tank of water, wait till the bubbles subside, raise the patient back out and try and revive them. Or an even more complicated contraption produced in Belgium in the late 18th, early 19th century, which was called the Chinese Temple, and it was kind of like a lift poised over a pond and with a set of pulleys, and again, the patient was locked in this iron cage and then lowered below the waterline and brought back up. Or the first use of the word tranquilizer in psychiatry is an invention by Benjamin Rush, who was one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence here in America, the most prominent physician in late colonial, early modern America. And Rush, who treated mental patients, if I can use that in inverted commas, at the Pennsylvania Hospital, invented a contraption he called the tranquilizer. The tranquilizer looks very much like an electric chair. And what it allowed was the patient's body to be completely immobilized, a contraption lowered over their heads, which was muffled so they couldn't hear sound, they couldn't communicate to the world, and the patient would be locked into this device for hours at a time, and threatened with a return to it if they didn't moderate their tongue and their temper and start to behave themselves. So there were a lot of devices of this sort.
Okay,
developed in that period.
We're coming up to the... Dr. Skoll, I only have time for one shorter answer today.
Okay, I'll try to be much briefer then.
Okay, psychiatric science and research is primarily today focused on a biomolecular and neuroscientific model, including genetics. And while viewing madness in MRI maps or discovering genetic anomalies may be useful at some point, I find myself still left with the odd analogy of which came first, the chicken or the egg analogy. The madness that triggered the abnormal biomolecular or genetic anomaly, or the physical challenge that resulted in mental disorder. And even then, at the end of the debate, it still doesn't satisfactorily define madness or its causes, especially since there is no scientific verification of a biochemical imbalance in the brain today. Your thoughts?
I think that's absolutely right, actually, Gary. I think that we have a lot of promissory notes being offered on the basis of pretty skimpy evidence. And indeed, we have some evidence that long-term use of antipsychotic medications, for example, actually changes the structure of the brain and shrinks it and causes, of course, some pretty severe iatrogenic or physician-caused illness, like tardive dyskinesia. So we really are at still a very primitive stage in understanding things. And I think suggesting that we'll be able to reduce everything to biology is a gross oversimplification. It's not likely to prove the case, though I do believe that it's very likely that in the more severe kinds of mental disorder, there will be some contribution from biology. I don't think that will ever be the entire story here.
We appreciate it. Look forward to another discussion. Professor Andrew Scull, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Gary, very much.
His book is Madness and Civilization, A Cultural History of Insanity, From the Bible to Freud, From the Madhouse to Modern Medicine. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to live back on the air at Progressive Radio Network is Utrice Leave. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. I'm doing well today. Still broadcasting from the hospital, but today we're talking about the overwhelming show of support and thanks, and we're also talking about the deception about Baltimore.
Okay. While you're there, would you ask any of the internists if they would agree to a lobotomy? You could do it while talking on them. They don't need anesthesia.
No anesthesia needed for that, actually.
Then again, you may be surprised. You get in there and find there's no brain there.
That's what I mean.
Utrice Leave right now.